Back on the record then. Mr. Johnson, you may cross.
Good morning, Dr. Muffberg. Good to see you again.
Good morning.
As you know, my name is Vo Johnson. I'm representing the government in this case. I want to start off by asking you a little bit about what you relied on. I know you were asked some questions on your direct about what formed the basis for your opinion. I believe you mentioned, I just wanted to confirm, that you have not performed an evaluation of Colin Dwyer. Is that correct?
That is correct. Okay.
And I take it you did not speak with his parents prior to preparing your report in this case.
Is that correct?
You mentioned in your report that you did discuss the case with Dr. Bach, is that right?
That is correct.
Why did you want to discuss the case with Dr. Bach?
In the initial medical records that I received, I saw that September 20th and September 22nd urine test. And it appeared to me that it would not be standard practice or logical to do two post-provoked urines so close together. And I suspected that the first test had been mislabeled through an administrative error. So I wanted to ask him about that and clarify that.
So it was the September 2002 urine test in particular that you were concerned about, that you wanted to speak with Dr. Bach about, isn't it?
That's correct.
Was there anything else that the two of you discussed when you met with him?
You know, we really didn't. We were at this think tank, and so I only asked about that lab, and then we ran out of time.
I want to talk now about the test results that you've discussed in your report and here today.
Yes.
The first, you discussed two different lab results from a laboratory, Immunosciences Laboratory. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And these are the antibodies to neurofilament and the antibodies to myelin basic protein?
That is correct.
And I'm going to refer to the antibodies to myelin basic protein as anti-MBP, if you don't mind.
That is perfect.
Okay. Doctor, do you order or have you ordered tests from Immunosciences in your own practice?
Yes, I have.
Okay. I want to show you a document that I found on their website. I guess mark this as a trial exhibit, and Special Master, in the May hearing, we were up to Respondent's Trial Exhibit 12, so we're going to start with Exhibit 13, if that's all right with you. Or would you prefer to do it?
Just trying to think of what's going to be less confusing. Let's go with 13. All right, and we'll probably renumber your exhibit then to be the next. Yeah, that makes more sense considering we're going to file these records in each other's cases. Okay.
Dr. Mepper, have you seen this before?
I have seen the Premier Autism Panel. I'm not sure that I've seen it actually on this website page.
Okay. Is it your understanding that this is a panel of tests that Immunosciences performs or offers in connection with autism?
That is correct.
Okay. In your opinion, is this a standard panel of tests for autism?
I would say no, this is not a standard panel for autism.
Do you order any of these tests for your own patients?
Sometimes. Frankly, one of the reasons that I don't order them very often is that they are expensive, and there are other tests that I typically would do first that might be able to be run through a local lab. But I have ordered a number of tests from them, and I've also used their lab for some research work that we've done.
And you mentioned that the tests can be expensive. Do you have an idea of how much these tests, for example, the Premier Autism Panel, if you ordered all of those tests, how much that would cost?
I think it's about $600, but expanded panels can be as much as like $1,200.
You agree that autism cannot be diagnosed through laboratory testing, correct?
I do agree.
The first Immunosciences lab test that you discussed in your report is the one that showed mildly elevated IgM neurofilament antibodies, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And this was a blood test, correct?
That's correct.
You state that this test result lends support to the conclusion that Colin experienced a neuroinflammatory process as described by Dr. Kinsborn, right?
I did.
Dr. Kinsborn said nothing about IgM neurofilament antibodies being a marker for neuroinflammation. Is that correct?
I think that is correct.
And you're aware that that a group of researchers has looked for serum and CSF markers of inflammation in autism. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And this was a study where the lead author was Dr. Zimmerman. Is that correct?
That's correct.
IgM neurofilament antibodies was not a marker that Dr. Zimmerman looked for in the serum or CSF of his autistic subjects to detect neuroinflammation. Is that correct?
I actually do not know. I remember there was a huge list of things they looked at in the CSF, and the thing that was really markedly elevated was interferon gamma. But I do not honestly recall if this was on that list.
Are you aware that circulating antibodies to neurofilament proteins have been demonstrated in many disorders, such as Alzheimer's and ALS?
Yes.
Isn't it just as likely that those findings are secondary to the ongoing pathological process as opposed to being the cause of the process?
The significance of that value to me was not necessarily looking at cause versus effect, but as a marker for neuroinflammation and reactive gliosis.
Isn't it true that certain medications could also cause elevated levels of antibodies to neurofilament proteins?
That may be true.
The second immunosciences test result that you discuss is the anti-MBP finding, which you state is a marker for autoimmunity. Is that right?
That's correct.
The mechanism of neuroinflammation proposed by Dr. Kinsborn is not an autoimmune response. Is that right?
It is a neuroinflammatory response. With immune dysregulation, we will often see evidence of autoimmunity. And we have evidence from the medical records as early as 4 months of age that Colin may have had immune dysregulation in that he exhibited what was recorded as nummular eczema versus tinea capitis. So I don't know for sure whether that was eczema or a fungal infection, but in either event, it is suggesting that at 4 months of age, he had some signs of immune dysregulation.
Dr. Kinsborn is not proposing demyelination as part of his mechanism in this case. Is that correct?
I think that's probably true. He's talking about neuroinflammation and reactive gliosis.
And Dr. Pardo, upon whom Dr. Kinsborn relies, does not endorse an autoimmune basis for autism. Is that right?
That may be true. Again, to document autoimmunity in a particular patient is not to say that autoimmunity is the cause of autism.
And Dr. Dieth's oxidative stress model is not based on autoimmunity, is that right?
That's correct.
Neither the myelin basic protein nor IgM neurofilament antibody test is diagnostic of any disease, is that right?
That's correct.
They are very nonspecific findings, is
that correct? That's
correct. And isn't it true that these antibodies have been reported as elevated in individuals and normal individuals with no disease?
That is true in some cases, exactly.
And because these markers were measured in the serum rather than the CSF, they provide no direct evidence of what is going on in Colin's central nervous system. Is that right?
I guess I would quibble with how you get direct evidence. In this case, to get direct evidence of neuroinflammation, I guess we would really need to have done a brain biopsy on him in 2002. I can tell you from personal experience that even wanting to look at CSF in children with autism for the presence of inflammatory markers is widely perceived as an invasive procedure. So those of us who might want to be able to document it more directly are constrained from doing so by standards of care criticisms. So we have to rely on other markers, and it's not a direct marker, but I would argue that a clinician would not have the ability to do a direct assessment in a living child.
For whatever reason, that evidence is just not present in this case, correct? The CSF testing is not present in this case.
That's true.
Do you know what protocol ImmunoSciences used to perform these two lab tests?
You know, I don't. I have visited ImmunoSciences labs on two occasions and talked to the director and viewed their facilities, but I am not a lab scientist, so I can tell you that when I visited and had it explained to me, it made sense to me at the time, but I could not reproduce the protocol.
Do you know how ImmunoSciences established its reference ranges?
I do not know the details of that, no.
Do you know whether these reference ranges take the age factor into account? In other words, are they normed for children?
I do not think they are normed for children, but for things like neurofilament antibodies and myelin basic protein antibodies, the values for children would be expected to be less than people as they aged and had more damage as a result of aging or disease.
But you don't believe that these reference ranges are normed for children?
I do not think they are. That's correct.
Do you know whether ImmunoSciences lab has ever been accredited by the College of American Pathologists?
I do not know if they have. I do know that their work, their lab reports come with disclaimers about use for research and careful clinical applicability and those types of things.
Do you know whether ImmunoSciences is currently performing any clinical testing?
I believe they are not.
I'm going to show you what we've marked as Respondents Trial Exhibit 14, and this is a letter that I found on the ImmunoSciences website.
Okay.
Doctor, have you seen this letter before?
Yes, I did. Okay. Yes, I have.
Okay. And does this letter reflect that ImmunoSciences has, in fact, stopped performing clinical testing as of July 21st, 2007?
Yes, as I just testified to.
Do you know why ImmunoSciences stopped performing clinical testing?
My understanding from talking to Dr. Vajani and some health department officials is that his lab was investigated for their testing as related to mold, looking for evidence of chronic mold exposure as a potential cause of chronic illness. My understanding from Dr. Vajani is that the investigation was perhaps precipitated by a court case in which mold testing had been used and the plaintiff who had claimed damage from mold had won a huge settlement. And the health department was concerned about the possibility of lawsuits being settled on the basis of that mold test and wanted to investigate the lab with regard to that.
So it's your understanding that the problems at ImmunoSciences lab were limited to its mold testing?
Well, that is my understanding, but I have not investigated all the depth of the investigation nor read any of the official documents, so I really do not have full knowledge of that.
I'm now going to show you a Respondent's Trial Exhibit 15, which is another letter that I found on ImmunoSciences' website.
Okay. Thank you.
Doctor, have you seen this letter before?
I believe I have, yes.
Did you receive this letter since it was it's addressed to our valued clients and associates? Was this sent to you?
Yes.
Okay. This letter is signed by Dr. Vajani.
That's correct.
And I believe you testified at the hearing in May that you have an article in press regarding one of your research projects on which Dr. Vajani is the lead author. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. Do you know what CLIA or CLIA stands for?
Oh, Certified lover. I can't remember because we always refer to it by the acronym. I'm sorry.
Okay, and just for the record, it's Clinical Laboratory Improvements Amendments of 1988, and we'll just refer to it as CLIA for ease of reference. Do you know what CMS is?
According to the letter, it might be Centers for Medicaid and Medicaid Services.
That's correct. CMS regulates all clinical laboratory testing on humans in the United States through CLIA in order to ensure quality laboratory testing. Is that right?
Uh-huh.
Dr. Vajani's letter states in the third paragraph that CMS had found deficiencies during a 2004 CLIA survey of immunosciences that led it to conclude that the lab's test results since 2002 may not be accurate and reliable. Were you aware of those findings by CMS?
Yes, since I got this letter.
I'm now going to show you Respondent's Trial Exhibit 16, and this is a letter from CMS. Doctor, have you seen this letter before?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Did you receive this letter?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And this letter does, in fact, say at the beginning of the second paragraph on the first page that we are writing both to inform you of the current sanction action and to alert you that test results you received since June 2002 from Immunosciences Lab, Inc. may not be accurate or reliable. Is that what that says?
That's correct. I would like to add for the special master that when I received this letter, I did call Mary Jew, as suggested in the last line. I can't remember the details now, but I talked to three different people on the staff. I tried to get information about what particular concerns they had because I was trying to figure out for the labs that I had done on my patients if this were a global concern or if it was related to the mold or if there were tests that I was using that I may still be able to rely upon. And I was very frustrated in not being able to find out from those people who I think their hands were tied in terms of talking about an ongoing investigation what the problems were.
We may be able to provide some of that information now. I'm going to show you now what's been marked as Respondent's Trial Exhibit 17. And this is the CLIA Annual Laboratory Registry from 2005. Have you seen this document before?
No, I have not.
Look on page 5 of this document. Does this indicate that Immunosciences' CLIA certification was being revoked due to condition-level noncompliance?
Cancellation of approval to receive Medicare payment due to noncompliance, yes.
Okay. And I'm going to show you Respondent's Trial Exhibit 18. And these are actually excerpts from a much larger report. And this is a report from the survey that CMS did of the Immunosciences Lab. Does that, based on your review of this document, does that appear correct to you?
Based on my 30-second review, that does appear to be correct.
Okay. If you'll turn to the fifth page of the trial exhibit, This document lists a number of findings in connection with Immunoscience's general immunology testing. Is that correct?
It appears that that is correct. Okay.
Were you aware that CMS noted problems at Immunoscience's lab in connection with its failure to follow written policies and procedures for an ongoing mechanism to monitor, assess, and correct problems in the pre-analytic systems?
No, I did not have access to that information.
Okay. And were you aware that the CMS found that the laboratory failed to determine calibration procedures and control procedures based upon established performance applications?
No, I wasn't aware of the specifics.
And were you aware that CMS found that Immunoscience's laboratory failed to verify the continued accuracy of the test system throughout the laboratory's reportable range of test results?
I'm sorry, what was that phrase, a portable range?
Reportable range of test results. This is subparagraph G.
That appears to be what the document says. Okay. I was not aware of the specifics.
Okay, and under subparagraph I, the CMS found that Immunoscience's laboratory failed to establish the statistical parameters of unassayed control materials used for its various in-house ELISA test systems.
I was not aware of that.
Okay. And these findings all relate to Immunoscience's general immune testing. Is that correct?
It would appear that that's the case.
Okay. And if you'll now look on the next to the last page of the trial exhibit. Were you aware that CMS found with respect to the anti-MBP and neurofilament test in particular that Immunoscience has failed to have written policies and procedures for patient preparation, specimen collection, specimen storage and preservation, conditions for specimen transportation, and specimen acceptability and rejection?
And what was the date of that was not in place? Because it seemed to be on the website when you cited it earlier, and when we sent specimens in 2003, we were able to obtain written instructions about the specimen submitted. They came actually in the test kit.
I believe this was a survey from 2004. So CMS apparently found at this time that at least whatever written procedures that they had were not adequate. Is that correct?
Well, that may be what they found. What I was trying to explain to you is, as a clinician, the test kits come in a box, and they're the tubes and then a series of explanations about how the specimens need to be prepared. So I can only testify as to what I know and to what you show me that's in the lab document, but I'm trying to explain that we had procedures to follow when we submitted our blood samples in 2003.
And all I'm asking you is that at the time that CMS performed this survey, it found those aspects of Immunoscience's laboratory practice to be inadequate. Is that correct?
Yes, that would be apparent from the document.
Okay. And if you now want to look at the last page of the trial exhibit, isn't it also true that CMS found at the time it performed this survey that with respect to the anti-MBP test and the neurofilament test, that Immunoscience's failed to provide documentation to show that the laboratory director's review and approval for those procedures?
It does suggest that there was no documentation to show his review and approval. I do know from talking to him that he did review those procedures. So how much of this was a matter of paperwork versus actual analysis, I can't say.
In Dr. Vajani's letter of January 16, 2006, he indicates that Immunoscience has planned to sue over the survey results. Were you aware of that?
I wasn't sure if he was going to sue. He said vigorously fight or something to that effect, which I wondered if he meant to go through administrative channels. So I didn't know the specifics of what he meant by that.
And that was referring to Respondent's Trial Exhibit 15?
Yes, Special Master. Thank you. We have a copy of the settlement agreement from that lawsuit. It's been marked as Respondent's Trial Exhibit 19. Focusing on paragraphs 1, 2, and 3, if you want to review those.
Okay.
It appears that one of the conditions of the settlement was that Immunosciences would obtain accreditation through the College of American Pathologists. Or else it would voluntarily withdraw from the CLIA program and cease testing on human specimens. Is that correct?
That does seem to be the case.
Okay. Based on the fact that Immunosciences is no longer performing clinical testing, isn't it reasonable to infer that they did not receive accreditation through the College
of American Pathologists? Or that they chose not to pursue it, I would think would be the two possibilities.
Doctor, based on this information, do you have any concerns about the reliability of the Immunosciences test results?
Yes, I do. I was not aware that the MVP or the neurofilament testing was under contention. And if that were the only thing that I was relying upon to make my judgment, I would be concerned that I had overread the labs. So I would give relatively less credence or perhaps even be forced to discount the reliability of those two particular lab tests given the information in the settlement agreement, which I wasn't privy to knowing the details of.
The next test results that you discuss in your report are results from Great Smoky's lab, which purport to show abnormal glutathione, lipid peroxide, cysteine, and plasma sulfate levels. Is that correct?
That's true.
This testing was done in July and December 2002. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So that would have been when Colin was in July approximately 3.5 years old and then in December a little over 4 years old. Is that
right? That's
correct. Okay. So to the extent that these results indicate anything about whether Colin was in oxidative stress at the time, they don't tell us whether Colin was in oxidative stress at the time he received his immunizations. Is that correct?
That's exactly correct.
These tests were blood tests. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Do you know whether these tests were normed for children?
I do not know the answer to that question.
And as you note in your report, a number of other factors can explain oxidative stress, such as poor nutrition. Is that right?
That's correct.
Would you agree that a mercury efflux disorder is still a hypothesis at this point?
Yes.
So low cysteine and plasma sulfate levels can't be diagnostic of that disorder. Is that right?
That's correct.
And those levels could also be explained by a number of other factors. Is that right?
That's correct.
The next testing data that you discuss in your report is the mercury testing, and you talked about some of the results during your direct testimony, but I'd like to go through all of the mercury testing that's in the record, if you don't mind.
Okay.
The first test that we were able to locate is at Petitioner's Exhibit 4, page 131. I believe that this is one that you did discuss. This was a test. The specimen was collected on April 19th, 2002. Is that right?
Uh-huh. Okay.
And this was a red blood cell elements test. Is that right?
That's correct. Okay.
And as I believe you testified, or you, I can't remember if you testified actually, was there any chelating agent administered in connection with this test?
Not in connection with this test, I would have to correlate it with Dr. Bach's notes and the parent history to know if he was actually getting a chelating agent during this time.
But as you sit here today, you've not tried to make that correlation.
I looked at the records with the labs, but I can't recall if he was on chelating agent or not. Should we find that out, or do you already know the answer?
I don't know the answer, okay. Actually. If you'd like to look, that would be fine. Okay.
It would appear that 4/19/02 was the time of the very first visit to Dr. Bach. So there is not evidence that he would have been on a chelating agent at that time.
And the result from this test for mercury was that it came back in non-detectable, the non-detectable limit. Is that correct?
Right.
The next test that we found was the September 20th, 2002 test, and this was a urine toxic metals test. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And I believe you testified that although this report indicates that there was a chelating agent administered, you don't believe that there was for this particular sample. Is that right?
Referring to exhibit 4, page 93.
Exactly. I apologize.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And the result for this test was mercury was in the non-detectable limit.
That's correct.
The next test was the September 22nd, 2002 test, which is at Petitioner's Exhibit 4, page 90. And I believe you testified that this was the post-provocative test. Is that
right? That's correct.
And this test result showed that mercury was at 17 micrograms per gram of creatinine. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. The next test result that we found was from November 3rd, 2002. That's when the sample was collected. And this was another urine toxic metals test. Is that correct? And this is Petitioner's Exhibit 4, page 85.
That's correct.
And this was a post-provocative test, correct?
That is the way that it's labeled.
So it appears that the chelating agent DMSA was administered in connection with this test. Is that right?
I'd like to check the contemporaneous medical record again, if I could, please.
Pages 11 and 12 may be helpful to
you.
Yeah,
I just found. Thank you. Okay, now I'm there. So, yes, I can't find anything in the actual medical record that that would say specifically about this lab test, but he did say decreasing DMSA to 100, I think, is what he's saying. That was on, that may have been on October 30th. Yes.
Okay. So that would indicate that Colin was on DMSA at the time that this sample was collected. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. And this test result showed a no detectable mercury. Is that correct?
That's correct. And it shows elevation in the lead, which DMSA also helps mobilize. One of the studies that we've done at ARI is looking at the relative rates of lead and mercury excretion. And one of the patterns that we've seen is that frequently lead will be elevated first and then mercury will come out second. So, but there was not any mercury coming out at this time on provocation. That's correct.
All right, let's look at the next test, which is at Petitioner's Exhibit 4, page 75. This is from a sample collected on December 11th, 2002. And I believe this is a result that you did discuss during your direct testimony. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, this is the red blood cell element test.
That's correct.
And again, as you testified, this test also resulted in non-detectable mercury. Is that correct?
Yes, that's the red blood cell test reflecting no acute exposures.
All right, let's look at the next test that we were able to find, which is at Petitioner's Exhibit 4, page 73. This is from a sample collected on December 29th, 2002. Mm-hmm. And this is a urine toxic metals test. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the test report indicates that DMSA was administered in connection with this test. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And this test also showed non-detectable levels of mercury. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the last test that we were able to find is at Petitioner's Exhibit 4, page 63. And this is from a sample collected on March 2nd, 2003. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And this is another urine toxic metals test. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the report indicates that DMSA was administered in connection with this test. Is that right?
That's correct.
And again, the result from this test for mercury was non-detect. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So in the medical records, there's only one test that showed mercury outside of the reference range. Is that correct?
That's true.
And that was the provoke test from September 22nd, 2002. Is that right?
That's correct.
Doesn't doctor's data say in bold right on the test report that reference ranges are representative of a healthy population under non-challenge or non-provoked conditions?
That's true.
So we just don't know what the normal range would be for a provoke test. Is that right?
It is difficult to know what that would be on a provoke test on either sick populations or healthy populations.
Doesn't the fact that on future post-provocation tests, Colin excreted no mercury, doesn't that indicate that he wasn't having problems excreting mercury on his own?
Does the fact that on post-provocation testing he was not excreting mercury imply that he was actually able to excrete it on his own and therefore did not need the provocation? Is that what you're suggesting?
That's what I'm asking.
I don't know if that's a conclusion you can draw. I'm taught that mercury excretion is variable and dependent on a number of factors. And so that would be one of the things that I would consider. But I would also consider the fact that he had mercury stores that were not accessible to the chelating agent.
So that would just be a possibility that you would consider?
Yes.
On page 6 of your report, you go on to discuss a number of other tests that you yourself state are not specific to any particular clinical presentation or symptom and are widely recognized to have causes other than metal toxicity or neuroinflammation and are not at all specific to autism spectrum disorders. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Would you agree that the single post-provocation test from September 2002 is the only evidence in the record specific to mercury?
That would be true.
If that test result were not reliable, take it away, you can't rely on it, would you still be able to offer an opinion in this case that thimerosal-containing vaccines contributed to Colin's autism?
Without that piece of evidence, I would be left with a number of lab tests that would be consistent with but not specifically suggestive of that. So I guess that would be true.
And the post-provocation test from September 2002 is not specific to a particular species of mercury, is that right?
That is true.
So it tells us nothing about Collins' exposure to ethyl mercury as opposed to methyl mercury, is that right?
That's correct.
And none of the other tests that you're relying on are diagnostic of mercury toxicity, is that right?
That's correct.
In fact, none of the other tests that you're relying on are diagnostic of exposure to mercury in any amount, is that right?
That would be true.
And all of the other test results that you're relying on could be explained by factors other than exposure to thimerosal and vaccines, is that right?
That's true. However, one would need to correlate with the child's history or the child's medical record what other things would be causing the ongoing oxidative stress, depleted glutathione, mild metabolic acidosis, abnormalities in amino acids, et cetera.
And you've indicated in your report even that something like poor nutrition can explain oxidative stress and things like
that. Can be a contributor to oxidative stress, that's correct.
And there's not a single test in the record that is diagnostic of neuroinflammation, is that right?
That would be correct. I'm not aware of any test that's diagnostic of neuroinflammation short of biopsy and pathology, but I may have missed some.
And in fact, I think you testified at the hearing in May that you're not aware of any good clinical markers for neuroinflammation. Is that still your understanding today?
I would say that if you had CSF markers of inflammation, that would be a nice indirect test, but I'm not aware of any gold standard test for neuroinflammation.
In May, you testified that you selected the Mead case because he had a history of antibiotics, multiple ear infections, respiratory infections, allergies, and asthma. Do you remember that testimony?
Yes, I do.
Those facts are not present in this case, are they?
That's true.
Colin was generally a healthy baby, is that right?
That's true.
In fact, I think according to the record, he only had two ear infections during the first 20 months of his life. Is that
I think that's correct.
You testified that you selected the King case because of his mother's antibiotic use during pregnancy and evidence of potential synergistic reactions to other exposures. Do you remember that testimony?
That's correct.
And those factors are not present in Colin Dwyer's case, is that right?
That's correct.
In both the Mead and King cases, you testified that your opinions were based in part on the apparent efficacy of various treatment methods employed by Dr. Green. Do you remember that testimony?
Yes, I do.
Isn't it true that Colin's parents reported to Dr. Russell that the Defeat Autism Now treatment protocols they tried were ineffective?
They may have reported that. They did tell me last night that they felt like some aspects were associated with his progress, but one of the difficulties here is that he was receiving multimodal interventions, and so it is difficult to isolate the efficacy or lack thereof of any isolated intervention when behavioral strategies and biomedical strategies were occurring at the same time.
So based on that answer, it's just we don't know whether the treatments were effective.
That's correct.
But at least at the time that the parents were going to see Dr. Russell, they reported that they did not believe that they were effective. Is that right?
I think that is reported in the record.
Thank you. That's all that I have.
Thank you.
Dr. Mumper, you testified that the low CO2 levels have wide differential.
That's correct.
And that screaming before a blood draw or a child who screamed a lot would be within that differential.
Yes.
And the records reflect that Colin is a screamer.
Yes. So that's why I was trying to be very careful and say that that was a very soft marker with all kinds of qualifications.
And you testified that the low amino acid levels in colon were another sort of soft marker.
The fact that they were, I would classify that as more than a soft marker, because the fact that his methylation amino acids were so low, I think, is pretty direct evidence, especially the very low taurine of 14. The issue is that because poor nutrition can contribute to the low amino acids, you're looking at an end result that may be from poor nutrition that would nonetheless impact the ability of the methylation biochemistry and the detoxification biochemistry.
So it would be both a marker and a cause.
That was a great way to put it. Thank you.
All right. The records reflect Colin as a problem eater.
That's true.
And a problem protein eater.
That's exactly true.
And that would affect amino acids.
Yes, and that may well be why they were so dramatically low across the board, because he was not taking in the precursors of protein. But when he had the low levels, that would go on and have further impact on things like oxidative stress, ability to detoxify.
I have no further questions. Mr. Powers?
Yes, I do have questions for redirect.
Hello again, Dr. Mumper. I want to follow up on some questions that the respondent's attorney asked you. You recall a question that he asked you if there were any other, if there are any medications that one might be taking that are associated with elevated levels of IgM neurofilament antibodies. Do you remember that question?
Yes, I do.
Do you see anything in the record indicating that Colin Dwyer was taking medication that would have led to elevated IgM neurofilament antibody levels?
No, I did not.
You were also asked a question about IgM levels being associated with Alzheimer's and other diseases. Do you remember that question?
That's correct, I do.
Do you see anything in the medical record suggesting that Colin Dwyer suffered from any disease that would be associated with elevated levels of IgM antibodies?
Other than possibly neuroinflammation, no. Not Alzheimer's, not other neurodegenerative diseases that typically affect older people.
So there's nothing in the medical record implicating any other drugs or any other diseases other than what you've described that would be associated with these elevated levels. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You were also asked whether these antibody tests, or excuse me, the neurofilament antibody tests were diagnostic of autism. Do you remember that question?
Not specifically, but I may well have been asked it.
All right. The autism diagnosis in this case,
right.
Who reached that autism diagnosis when you go back to the medical records?
Well, that diagnosis was reached by the pediatric neurologist, and the important factor is that autism is fundamentally a disease that's diagnosed on the basis of history and symptoms. There are a list of criteria, and therefore, the constellation of criteria is what is able to make the diagnosis. That's why we're so careful to say that there is no currently available biomedical marker for autism.
And you're certainly not claiming in your opinion that your assessment of Colin as suffering from an autism spectrum disorder, that specific conclusion does not rely on any lab result, does it?
Oh, that's absolutely correct.
You also were asked questions about reference ranges and the normalization of those ranges for children versus adults. Do you recall that line of questioning?
Yes, I do.
It was your testimony that the levels, that the normal ranges, you would actually expect a child to have lower within the reference range than an adult would be, correct?
I would expect that, but if the the actual survey data has not been collected, I'm not aware that I could prove that.
But if the reference ranges are set to fit with an adult would typically be expected to have more of these neurofilament antibodies in his or her system as a consequence of aging, correct?
That's correct. That's my understanding.
So in that sense, would it be fair to say that the reference range as it applies to children is, you would expect children to be lower, and it's
that's
a very
correct.
Conservative range?
That is correct.
So in a sense, these mildly elevated levels in a child based on the adult range are a higher elevation than it would be for an adult, correct? Is it? Would it be your testimony that?
What I would say is that expecting children not to have evidence of neuroinflammation or neurodegenerative diseases, a level of 53 or 57 in a toddler would be more concerning or more unexpected to me than those same levels in a middle-aged or elderly person. Is that fair? Yeah.
You were asked a question about the mercury efflux disorder as being a hypothesis. Do you remember that question?
Yes.
And what was your answer to that question?
I don't remember.
Would you trust me if I said that your answer was that, yes, it was a hypothesis?
Yes. It is one of the things that we are postulating in regard to causation. It's part of the model. Is that fair?
Yeah, well, and it's your answer, so if that's your answer, then are you aware of testimony or facts that are in evidence through the Mead and the King cases supporting the idea that mercury efflux is an actual condition that may exist in people?
That was, I think, the substance of Dr. Aposian's testimony in the Mead and King cases.
And you would you be relying on Dr. Aposian's testimony to posit the idea that children might have a mercury efflux disorder?
Yes, I do. Through my discussions with Dr. Aposian, he has vast amount of experience with heavy metals, particularly mercury, that predates mine. And so, yes, I do rely on his analysis of the experiments and the literature.
You were also asked questions about what a normal result would be of a post-provocation urine test for metals. Do you recall that question?
Yes, I do.
And do you recall saying that one doesn't know exactly what a normal result would be? Do you remember that discussion?
Right.
Do you consider a lab result with a finding that is five times or greater beyond the reference range to be normal under any definition of normal?
I do not consider that to be normal. I consider it very concerning. And I do think that one of the difficulties we're going to have in setting norms is to find people that are not living in an industrial society and are not exposed to heavy metals. Because I think the normals pre-industrial revolution would have been very different than the so-called normals now.
And whatever the reference range is, would you describe Colin Dwyer's post-provocation urine test where it was five times beyond the reference level, would you describe that as normal or abnormal?
Abnormal.
You were also asked whether there was anything else in the record specific to mercury exposure other than the provoked chelation tests?
Yes.
Would you consider Colin Dwyer's immunization record to be evidence of mercury exposure?
Oh, that is evidence of mercury exposure. That's correct.
You were also asked about whether there is evidence of acute mercury toxicity in Colin Dwyer. Do you recall that?
No, I don't. I do not find evidence of acute mercury intoxication in him, however.
Okay. The lack of evidence of acute mercury intoxication, does that change your opinion at all about whether thimerosal-containing vaccines contributed to his regression?
No, it does not. With thimerosal-containing vaccines and the mechanism as we best understand it, the concern is for relatively low amounts to cross into the immature brain and incrementally increase over time with a great difficulty in getting it out of the brain, a very long half-life. So we have never intended to imply acute mercury toxicity. Our concerns are much more with chronic exposure that accumulates at a critical developmental window. And so in this particular case, one of the things that concerns me now is that he received a very large load very early. The hepatitis B at birth, 13 days and 7 weeks, and then the other routine immunizations. So at a time when his brain was undergoing a tremendous amount of important work, he received a thimerosal-containing vaccines.
And again, what is your opinion as to what the mechanism of injury is in this particular case? That is it an acute exposure to mercury, or is it something else? And if it's something else, exactly what is your medical opinion here as to what contributed to Colin's autism?
My opinion is that he received a series of thimerosal-containing vaccines, and that he was subject over time to accumulation in his brain, that it was a chronic exposure, not acute, and that his symptoms manifested later as a result of this chronic deposition in his brain, kidney fat, and potentially lymphatic glands.
Finally, you were asked a series of questions after each of these lab results as to whether that lab result is indicative of either autism or mercury body burden. Do you remember those questions?
Yes, I do.
Is it your testimony today that you're relying on any one individual test to inform and base your opinion on?
No, quite the opposite. It's the constellation of laboratory values in conjunction with the most important piece, which is the history of the child. And there is no easily available biomarker for autism that I'm aware of, and I've talked to a lot of researchers about that very issue.
Would it be fair to say that it's the collection of this wide range of tests that informs your opinion rather than any one test result in and of itself? Is that fair?
That's absolutely correct. But the pattern that is striking to me in this case is the number of different labs that collectively support a picture of a child with known mercury exposure, known excretion of mercury with provocation, and then multiple other lab tests that would be evidence of the metabolic processes going on in his body that were either causally or subsequent to those kinds of problems with toxicity.
Great. I have no further questions. Thank you, Special Master.
Mr. Johnson.
Dr. Mumper, with respect to the September 22, 2002 post-provocation mercury test, you just testified that it's your belief that that result is abnormal, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. There is no data that would support that statement. Is that correct? There is no data to show what normal reference ranges would be for post-provocation testing. Is that correct?
To my knowledge, that is true.
Okay. Thank you.
Let me get this straight, Dr. Mumper. I want to make sure I understand that. If I took 103-year-olds off the street out in front of the White House today and we chelated them, you're telling me that there is no data that would give us a reference range for where they would fall on mercury post-chelation?
I'm not aware that has been done. It desperately needs to be done. It's one of the things that we are doing at our research institute is to try to compare porphyrin testings to in normal children versus controls, because that data has not been established. It's classically hard to get people to volunteer their children at very young ages for research experiments in which they're being used just to set a control. I've tried to do it in my practice, especially if it involves anything either invasive or troublesome, like taking home a kit and collecting a first morning urine and bringing it back. It's difficult to get people to participate in that, but I agree that it definitely needs to be done.
Okay, and there is no data then that would show in anyone the increase between pre-chelation and post-chelation levels of lead or mercury?
There is data that shows that it increases, but the quantification of the amounts that correlate with a specific body burden have not been determined to my knowledge.
When we chelate and we measure the amount of mercury excreted afterwards, mercury, lead, whatever heavy metal.
Right.
You're saying, I understood that to be a measurement of body burden of mercury.
It is reflective of an increased body burden. I'm saying that what I don't have is the data to tell you that a four-year-old child would go from 0.01 micrograms per gram of creatinine to 17 micrograms per gram of creatinine if he had a total body burden of X grams of mercury. I don't know how to get that information. So
then what I'm having trouble understanding is why you can say that 17 is extraordinarily high. What do you base that on? I'm not arguing with you, Doctor. I just want to understand what the basis of the opinion is if there is no reference.
The basis for my opinion, I would have to say, is looking, is discussions with leaders in the toxicology field and extrapolations from experiences in older populations, but there is a dearth of that information in the pediatric population.
Okay. Questions from either side based on mine?
Not from the petition section, Master.
All right. Dr. Mumper, you may step down. Mr. Powers, Mr. Farrell, where are we going from here?
Well, Dr. Mumper was the last of the three witnesses petitioner planned to call in this case, so we're done with our case in chief and Colin Dwyer's claim for compensation.
Okay. Government, are you prepared to proceed with your first witness?
Yeah, I know it's a little early for a lunch break, but we could have a break before we put on our witness.
How much time do you need? It is early for a lunch break, and I anticipated that we would be pushing on through lunch in order to ensure that we get Dr. Leventhal out of here.
If we're going to push on through lunch, we could have a half an hour now. My direct is not going to be that long.
Okay. You're the one who's got to get him out of here on time. So if you need a half an hour, we'll reconvene then at, let's make it five after.